thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to have a chat and, yeah, talk about life. And, yeah, it's good. Thank you.
Absolutely. So, Helen, can you just give us a little bit of a background about just where you are and, like, kind of who you are right now? And then we'll dive back in just so we have a little bit of context for the audience.
Sure, absolutely. So, kind of my where I am at the moment is work-wise, I'm a property investor. I've been doing that kind of professionally for kind of the past 4 or 5 years. I have a background in finance and investment banking, so we can kind of touch on that later. But I kind of fit that in. I very much have an approach to life that, well, I try and make it a kind of a lifestyle, kind of like business, if you will. I love being in the sun. I love to travel. I love to learn. And I found something that I love doing that facilitates that lifestyle that I like. So, yeah, it works for me.
Awesome. So you combined a love and put the lifestyle one in the same.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I looked kind of around. I have, you know, there's been a few moments that make you take stock of your life. And a few of those make you think, actually, how do I really want to spend my life? What do I enjoy doing? How can I make money at something I enjoy doing, which will give me the lifestyle that I want? And I realized that for me, that certainly, I'm British, as you can tell from my accent. And for me, the UK is not a really fun place to be in the winter. You know, those clocks change in the autumn, the fall. And yeah, I'm out of here. It's just not my idea of fun. So I kind of head off to sunnier climes then, and that's what I enjoy. And that makes me happy. And so that's how I've set my life up to be able to facilitate that, basically.
Lovely. So a woman who has a background in finance and property investing, what were you into as a child?
Do you know, this is funny. I was thinking about this earlier today because somebody asked me a slightly different question. By the age of 10, I think I had 10 bank accounts, savings accounts. There was a kind of, in the UK at that time, and we are talking 70s, showing my age there, there was such a thing as called a building society. And the banks as well ran promotions for kids, obviously targeting that part of the market. And they had all these gimmicks and freebies and things to get kids to open accounts with them with a view to being kind of lifelong savers. I actually think I still have most of those accounts, albeit some of the banks themselves don't exist now, which is interesting. So I would just go along and I'd deposit my £10 or whatever it was, my Christmas money, my birthday money, you know, my pocket money, my pound a week, and go along, open an account, get the freebie. There were these little like piggy banks from a certain bank at the time. Somebody else was giving away, some NAF sports bag. But, you know, age 10 or whatever you are, that's quite fun. So I actually was always into kind of money and saving and kind of spreadsheets and numbers. I also found, I've been doing a lot of spring cleaning lately, and I found a notebook. I always have a notebook on me. Mm-hmm. And I found one from probably around that age where me and my dad had written like a graph, divided the page into graphs, and we had basically entries, book entries of my pocket money every month, the cumulative total, and then he'd sign for it. And when I made a withdrawal, he'd sign for it. So we kind of had this Excel spreadsheet, but in this little notebook, you know. Like I say, well, that was probably the 80s by that point. But I was like, oh, my God, I was always a numbers geek.
Was your dad into banking?
He wasn't, actually. Not really. But all my family have always been very kind of conservative and into savings. They're kind of not frivolous. They were very, you know, you kind of live within your means. You don't kind of, you know, credit. We don't go there with credit. So I've just got that kind of conservative, sensible approach to investing and saving and where that gets you. And that's worked well for them and it works well for me. But that was instilled in me as a child. But the property thing was also there. I think I don't know if that's a British thing or, again, just maybe my family. But I knew that part of my strategy was to buy my own place as soon as I could like physically, you know, had the cash to be able to afford it. So mm-hmm. I bought my very first property when I was kind of early 20s when I'd moved to London after university. And yeah, and actually we have my granddad built me. We lived in a bungalow growing up, and my granddad built me a doll's house that was a bungalow because uh-huh. you just couldn't buy them. So I used to spend a lot of time like playing with that and moving furniture around and painting the walls. And so, yeah, property and design and that stuff's always been there for me as well. So and now I do the two, and yeah, that makes me super happy.
With the property, are you really into the interior and the design aspect of it as well?
I am. I really do like that stuff. I'm less involved in that from a professional perspective, but I take a big interest in it, in my personal stuff. The flat that I'm in kind of here at the moment, I literally mm-hmm. had it for a few years as a buy-to-let, and I literally gutted the whole thing. A fabulous friend of mine, Carolina Ademchik from Ademchik, a super, super talented lady. She did it all for me. I kind of went off on one of my little jaunts to Bermuda, and I said, there you go, there's the keys. You know, we designed it all beforehand. Right. And she did everything for me. And, you know, I just had kind of calls from Bermuda, and she would show me around what we were doing. But we ripped everything out back to kind of the brick. And yeah, that was really good fun, really good fun. Lovely, creative process.
Yes.
To, you know, kind of express, you know, your own kind of personal style, and she's got fabulous taste. So, yeah, kept me. Yeah, when I was wanted to go a bit eclectic, she kept me kind of on the straight and narrow with that. So,
yeah, growing up, did you have when your own household, was your house like really well furnished and designed growing up, or was that more of something that was like you felt that was missing out of your life?
I think probably something missing. That's not a big, yeah, not a big thing for my parents, but we've always lived in the same, it's a lie. I moved when I was two, and then I lived in the same house my parents are still there. So once I came to London, to be honest, I kept moving around. So I don't know if that was kind of compensating for that a bit. But no, that's not really their thing. That's much more kind of my thing. Yeah.
So, and then you went to the University of Oxford.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I studied politics, philosophy, and economics. I'd kind of done maths a lot and economics as kind of A-levels to go on to university, liked the numbers kind of stuff. And the economics kind of really got me into, you know, kind of like the world and, you know, what's going on in the news and the economy and business and trade and those kind of concepts really fascinated me, so I wanted to take that further at Oxford. So, and it was nice to have that mix actually, politics, philosophy, and uh-huh. And economics. I think I was a little young really to get the philosophy kind of aspect of it. I took modules in kind of philosophy of mind, so I was really interested in like the psychology,
right.
Human behavior kind of side of stuff. Whereas now I think if I went back, I think I'd even enjoy it even more because that's why I spend kind of a lot of my time reading, you know, all the great philosophers and, yeah, looking at life and, yeah.
How long were you at Oxford?
4 years.
Okay, 4 years.
4 years, yeah, beautiful place. Again, beautiful kind of architecture and buildings in. It's a very iconic place. The student accommodation wasn't anything to write home about. I believe it's a bit better now, but, yes, at the time it wasn't fabulous, but.
Did your
character building?
Yeah, did your love for design and finance continue to grow as you were studying there?
Absolutely, yes. So what my parents did do with me, which I think was very clever, a lot of my friends thinking something about myself here. My friends would get kind of their allowance, the money for the whole term, and just quite short terms at Oxford, 8 weeks. They'd get the whole money at the beginning of it. Well, we were students, right? You know, by 4 weeks in, a lot of them had spent all that money because, you know, we didn't especially know how to manage money, and there's a lot of fun things to spend your money on then. And my parents kind of knew that I would have that propensity to just, you know, kind of fritter it away. So they decided actually what they'd do with me is get me used to having a salary, because that was what was going to go on and happen after, and I got paid monthly. So there was no point, at any point was I ever allowed to kind of run out of money in a big way. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly I'd get to kind of 3 weeks and I'd be, you know, kind of living on baked beans for that last week. But they paid me my allowance on a monthly basis. So I had to manage that money. And actually, when you have to manage it for you know, kind of 4 weeks, as opposed to a much bigger, you know, amount for the whole 8 weeks, it was easier and it was great training. And doing that, being used to that monthly kind of income for 4 years, by the time then I did start work, I'm, you know, this is what I'm used to. You know, and it's... You start to work out, well, if I save here and I put this money aside, or then, you know, then that'll allow me to do that. Yeah, just money management. It was very clever of them, really, in hindsight.
It sounds like it. Mm. So yeah. you go to Oxford, and then what happens after Oxford?
I went straight to London, got a job at JP Morgan. Straight into finance on the foreign exchange trading floor. I knew a lot. I kind of fell into it, but I don't know. All these things happen for a reason, don't they? I knew a lot of things that I didn't want to do. I wasn't quite exactly sure what I did want to do. And then when I got offered, actually, do you know what? The honest, truthful answer is my boyfriend at the time was working at a different bank also on the trading floor. And he had really wanted a job at JP Morgan because the training was for the graduate program was this, you know, kind of really elite kind of program. And I just decided, out of being a little overly competitive, that I'm going to get a job at JP Morgan to piss him off. And yeah, and I managed to do that. And he wasn't too bitter about it. He was doing very well where he was. But yeah, that's actually why I wanted that job and why I was determined to get that job.
A little leverage on him.
Yeah.
So how is it? How was it being? I mean, I could imagine working first of all at a bank and then on the trading floor. There's probably not too many women.
There really wasn't. Let me think how many there was at that time. I don't know, maybe another couple of salespeople. A lot of the assistants were women and actually are still very, very good friends of mine. I was on holiday with them a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, I mean, really in the minority, kind of less than 5%. But actually, I'd had good training at university because my college, Oxford, is in lots of little colleges. Mm-hmm. And my college at Oxford had been a big rugby college. So I think the ratio of kind of men to women there was 4 men to every woman there. So I was used to that male energy, those egos, that competition. And it was actually a great training ground, as was my childhood, because I had a big, very domineering older brother. But great training ground for the trading floor. And, you know, you do have to be a particular, or you did at that time. I think, again, things have slightly changed now. You do have to be a particular kind of person, a particular kind of woman. You have to be able to hold your own and perhaps not too kind of overly sensitive. But it's great fun. It's great fun.
What type of hurdles and challenges did you have while working on the floor and in the trading floor? Are there any really big ones that just like really stick out to you that you really had to like just you thought, oh shit?
I think, you know, because it was so male dominated, you know, the moments where you do have your, you know, as kind of women, we can at certain times of the month especially tend to be a little more emotional and lose a little bit of rationality. And yeah, you really had to. You know, there were times where I'd want to cry, and you know you just didn't do that. You were just going to be annihilated for kind of showing like not weakness, but kind of taking something a little too personally. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody would comment on your dress or your shoes or. You know, which again, when you're younger and perhaps less mature, those things get to you a little bit more than, you know, now I'd be like, I'm sod you, I don't like your face either, but you know, there you go. at the time, so it's just, but it was all kind of character building and you just learn your, you know, your own coping mechanisms, or you just remove yourself to the toilet and you have your moment and then you pull it together and you come back and you just get on with it. So yeah, it's yeah, it was, but it was good. It was really good fun. It was great camaraderie. You know, the level of kind of mental stimulation and the intellect of these people was just fascinating and fabulous to be around. Yeah, it was a great atmosphere.
Did you end up buying your first property, your first home, while you were working at JP Morgan?
Yes, I did. I was very young, literally as soon as I could. Actually, what happened was the place that I was renting, which is like bang in the middle, zone one, in the middle of London, in Covent Garden of all places, which is kind of West End theatre district, but was 5 minutes from work, because I had to be in on the trading floor at 6 a.m. every day. And one day, we used to take in turns one day a week to be in at 5 a.m. to kind of pull all the research together, understand what had happened overnight in the Asian markets. So I wanted to live really closely. And that my landlord was selling the property. And I just knew that was, and I loved it. It was this tiny, tiny little one bedroom. Gosh, it wasn't even, well, technically it was one bedroom, but it was really a glorified studio. It was the size of a matchbox. It was, you know, yeah, I'm not sure it would actually be legal to home pets in it these days. It was that small, but that was all I needed, because I was working, you know, ridiculous hours. So, but yeah, I bought that when I was kind of early 20, probably about 1999. Yeah, gosh, it might even be last century, 1999, 2000, something like that. And yeah, I loved it. And I just knew it was a great way to build wealth as well.
Mm-hmm.
There were concerns in the property market, as there are in the UK at the moment, about, oh, and about, are we at the top? What's going to happen price-wise? But ultimately, you know, as my mum said to me at the time, you're always going to need somewhere to live. So as long as you can keep paying that, you're going to have to pay rent anyway. Why not pay yourself? And, you know, if you keep thinking, if your time horizon, your perspective is long enough on this kind of investment, you'll be fine. So yeah, I did that and never looked back. Yeah.
How long did you end up living there for?
I was a little bit kind of rogue when I was younger. I used to move every 2 years. So I lived there 2 years. And then I bought another place and lived there 2 years. And then I know another place and I moved there and lived there 2 years. So kind of hopped around. But, you know, very fortunately, it was a time when the housing market in London particularly was going up. So I was always kind of banking the equity, the capital appreciation in it, getting somewhere else, and kind of always managed to find a really good deal and get in a good price. And built a lot of wealth up that
way.
So
buying a home, living in there, and then selling it, and then buying a new one.
Yeah. Would normally kind of do something to add value to it as well. Do it up, or you know, add value some way to it as well. And and then move on. So yeah,
How long did you end up staying at JP Morgan?
I was at JP Morgan 11 years.
Okay, so yeah. 11 years at JP Morgan, what led to you going out on your own?
Well, I was going to say it wasn't my choice. It kind of was my choice on the subconscious, but I made myself really ill. I burnt myself out. I annihilated my adrenals. And and then basically my friends, I made myself ill. They couldn't work out what was wrong with me. And I just kept kind of pushing and it'll be fine. I'll work through this. And my friends kind of took an intervention one night at a social thing. They're like, you're going to kill yourself if you don't leave. So I took a few months off. And once I had a few months off, I gained perspective and realized that, I couldn't go back. I couldn't continue to live and do to my body what I'd been doing kind of previously. So
what was going on with your adrenals and your symptoms?
It wasn't really too much fun. I'm working on a trading floor. So you're there when it opens and you're there till it shuts at least. And actually by that time I was kind of in on the business management side of stuff. So my day didn't finish when the markets closed. But I had kind of the opposite symptoms to what people with chronic fatigue or ME normally have. Normally they can't sleep. I couldn't stay awake.
Like
so
narcolepsy.
I would, Yeah, they tested me for that, and then they put me on some really funky, weird drugs for a while, which, yeah, basically kind of methamphetamine-type stuff to try and keep me awake. And no, I slept through that as well. And actually, it was just after that that I left, because I'm like, my God, if they're pumping you full of amphetamines and you still can't stay awake, then there's something really wrong there.
Yeah.
But yeah, my boss at the time was fantastic, very, very understanding. And he would kind of let me come in I'd be in at 9 and I'd leave on the dot at 5. There used to be a taxi waiting for me outside of the office to take me home. And I was only like a 20-minute taxi ride. Again, I've always lived close to work just because it was practical. And I'd be asleep before, you know, within a few minutes of sitting down in that taxi. But you know, they knew where to take me, but I couldn't even stay awake that long. I'd get in through the door, I wouldn't even like take my jacket off, just pass out on the bed, and I'd be there till my fiance at the time got home. You know, he'd bring food or wake me up to eat, and I'd be straight back to sleep. So yeah, I drank a lot of coffee in those days. The things that we do, huh?
So you ended up taking a sabbatical from JP Morgan and never came back.
Yes, that wasn't the plan. And at the time, I had a lot of self-judgment about it. It felt like I'd failed. I felt like, you know, like I'd been defeated almost. So it was a really tough time for me. And yeah, that year got even tougher because it was actually, it was 2008. I don't know if you remember what happened in 2008, but yeah, so actually, it, with hindsight, as all these things are, the way they work out is kind of beautiful in one way. So I left at the beginning of 2008, so just kind of pre-credit crunch. But my fiance at the time was actually at Lehman Brothers. So we had that spectacular week of that going belly up. So that was a really challenging time, a very interesting year. And now I can look back and laugh, and now it's a great story. But at the time, let me tell you, I cried for a week. Yeah, that we lost a lot of capital in that event. But yeah, it's again, you learn from these things. And yeah, and like I say, now I'm much more philosophical about that stuff. So,
right. So, 2008, you go through this transformation, this change. Where does the property investment start to come back into play with this?
Well, 2008 was particularly challenging because I'd effectively had everything that I pinned my identity on. You know, I work for an investment bank. We had this amazing lifestyle. We had a penthouse. We had the holidays. You know, I was engaged, and all that kind of fell away.
All of it went away.
Yes. So I was very kind of lost for a while. You know, when you're kind of living in other people's values. And
yeah.
I think that's basically a lot of what contributed to me making myself ill as well. You know, it really takes a lot of introspection. So that's when I found kind of the deep martini work. And it started on that process of really examining who I was, getting to know me, getting to know what I wanted, rather than trying to keep other people happy and do what they wanted or they thought I should do. So I didn't work for a few years. I mean, fortunately, I'd got redundancy when I left JP Morgan. So I had some cash in the bank. So that was very fortunate. And my fiance at the time was very supportive. But we bought a big house in 2010 and kind of did a couple of like property courses to understand kind of opportunities and how to go about things. And it was from there, again, we bought this big house that needed some work doing to it and added a lot of value there. And that was the point at that time had just been to do kind of stuff for myself and stuff for us. And then, as I say, then that relationship kind of fizzled and went away. and yeah, on my own and like, right, okay, what do we do next? So yeah, again, lots of education, lots of learning, lots of reading, lots of speaking to people. And then I started going to kind of property events, property meetups in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, all the stars aligned at one of the first one that I went to. And run by a guy called John Corrie, who's fabulous. Actually, I was at his event last night as well, listening to another great speaker. And I met fabulous people, very giving people, very willing to share their knowledge, share their learnings, you know, help people out, you know, give them really sensible advice. None of this get rich quick or, you know, you can be a property millionaire overnight.
Right. Just
sensible advice. Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, and it's one of my kind of pet hates of this industry, that those messages are still out there. And it's quite seductive to some people, and they believe that stuff. And I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not possible for most people.
Mm-hmm.
So I try and talk kind of, you know, a sensible message, and John certainly does that as well. But I met a lot of the people that I invest, a lot of the developers and people that I work with, you know, even today, people that I met at that very first meeting. So it was really, really meant to be. It was right place, right time. Call that luck, or say you make your own luck, I don't know. But yeah, it was beautiful synchronicity.
What was your first property investment after this whole transformation occurred for you through JP Morgan Chase?
I did a few. I didn't do just one. I did a few because I'm very into kind of diversifying risk. I kind of had a pot of cash, and I didn't want, you know, I wouldn't put, and I still don't, it's still part of my approach, my philosophy of investing. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. I also started off very small. I think my very first investment was £1,000 or £2,000 in a deal, because I wanted to understand the process. I wanted to be involved in that project, understand kind of what could go wrong, or just, you know, learn. It was all part of the learning process for me. So I did a few very small deals like that. And I mean small in relative scale to the kind of the size of the project. And I also did a project with a couple of, they're still very good friends of mine, Carolina, who I mentioned already, and Thomas Escobeck of Century Spaces. They were doing a project up in North London. And I put, I was one of a few investors in that. And that was a more significant amount of money. But really got me into thinking about how to approach investment in terms of what kind of the risk reward ratio. What am I expecting? What's my return on this? What's the risk I want to take? How much money am I happy to put in with that I can sleep at night?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, as I say, I don't stick everything in one go. And also, when you're first learning and you're on the beginning process and you're working with new people as well, just, you know, stick a small amount in, see how it works. Can you work together? Do those people do what they say they will do? How are you treated as an investor? And I think it was a really sensible approach, and I still do it that way, you know, kind of years down the line now. That's still my approach. You know, I'm doing kind of bigger size, but it's still the same approach of, let's start off with a relatively small amount. Let's see if we can work together. You don't want to get into something. You don't want to, A, I want to be able to sleep at night because I still have to manage my adrenals.
Right.
That's the, you know, fundamental principle of mine. Can I sleep at night? And it's all a learning process. You don't want to get in, and you want to have somebody that you can really have kind of open conversations with. It's property. There's going to be problems. There's going to be unexpected issues. There's going to be time delays. How do they manage that conversation? How do you manage that conversation? Can you have an open dialogue? I just work with people that's how we operate, that we can be very open and honest with each other.
With what you like to invest in, are you investing in properties that you guys are buying, fixing up, and then turning around and selling? Or are these more, are you doing rentals, or is a little bit of both?
There's a whole kind of range of strategies, and I've done kind of lots of different things. So some of them, we haven't held any. That's more a product of kind of where the market in the UK is at the moment. I suspect that might change, because I think the opportunities to get in and hold some stuff are going to be coming up over the next year. But we've done some kind of title splits. We bought a property. We did a project over in Bristol where there was kind of two flats and a two-bedroom property, but all under one title, like the legal title. They're all separate residences, but split that out, refurbished them, and kind of sold that on. We've done some project where there's an element of commercial, so where they have, you know, a kind of a retail unit on the ground level. We've done some stuff where there's a planning gain, so you get a property or a piece of land, and you apply to build bigger, build out, build, you know, something bigger than is there already at the moment on it. Planning uplift, I should say. I have a couple of friends who are very particular about that term, planning uplift. So different strategies, really. And, you know, my strategy has kind of changed because of where the market and the economy in the UK is going as well. So there's different ways you can invest. You can be a kind of an equity investor. That means that you're in there for kind of the capital appreciation on it. Or actually, there's a lot more kind of debt deals going around now. They're kind of bonds where it's a fixed return and a fixed time scale on it. I like those at the moment because this market is so uncertain. Mm-hmm. That to have that element of, you know, as much certainty as you can kind of get, I kind of like that. I'm, as you can probably tell, I'm quite at the risk averse end of the
conservative
when it comes to investment. Yeah.
So with that approach, I would imagine that you being more on the conservative side, that you haven't probably had to deal with some major mountains and hills to climb of emotions and things going wrong with properties because you're so diversified.
No, exactly. That's the whole principle, and that's what kind of basically determines how much I put in a deal at what point. And then literally, I kind of tune into it in my body almost. I'm like, right, if I put this amount, how does that feel? How does that sit with me? And I will feel uncomfortable in my stomach, and I'll be like, right, okay, that's too much. Okay, well, how does this amount feel? And it has to be, you know, because of all the kind of the stuff that we know as well, there has to be kind of not none, but as little emotion. These can't be emotionally driven decisions, or, you know, kind of an emotional investment. That's what leads to sleepless nights, and that's what I'm, you know, I kind of try and stay away from. I mean, property is by its very nature is kind of roller coastery,
right?
So I think as an investor or somebody looking in to get into that stuff, you have to be prepared for that. I mean, you know, I worked on a trading floor. So again, I'm kind of used to that roller coastery type of environment, but don't add to it by being emotionally invested as well. If you can keep yourself stable, then you're going to better weather those peaks and troughs. And that's what it's about for me.
What's your personal philosophy on home ownership? Because I know there's people out there say, don't buy a home. There's other people say, buy a home. And from your experience, and you know, you're in the world of property investment, what's your philosophy on that?
It's the way that I've built a really significant part of my wealth. If nothing else, it's tax efficient. I don't know how it works in the States, but in the UK, if it's your, we call it PPR, principal primary residence, if it's your home, you have it, you live in it, and then you sell it, which is basically why I used to move every 2 years, mm-hmm. buy it, sell it, live in it, and all that capital appreciation is tax-free. You've got to earn twice as much as that and pay all your taxes on income to get that same amount, you know, physical amount in your bank account. So for me, it's really worked. Yes, you know, there's an element of, as I've been doing that, I've added value and the market has been in my favor. So,
right.
You know, I'm not saying I've been super clever about this, but But I've also done it sensibly. I never overstretched myself on what I bought as well. Mm-hmm. So I could definitely afford those payments. You know, at the time I had a job that was just nice regular income. And actually for me as well, I was quite sensible about, so in banking, you used to get bonuses at the end of the year. So I was never one to kind of go and buy a sports car or I bought a lot of shoes, but they're a slightly different price point to a Ferrari.
Different style of
yeah.
sports car.
Yeah, exactly. But that bonus went straight off the mortgage. So, you know, I was kind of sensible about managing my exposure to the risk and the kind of those liabilities that I had. So I'm in favor of it, provided it's done sensibly. I think mm-hmm. it's a really good way to build wealth. But I think a lot of people, but I also think, you know, it's with everything, you need to do your homework on it. I would do a lot of analysis. I'm numbersy, but a lot of analysis on, is that the right price for that property? And when I saw a mismatch in that's the wrong price, i.e. that property is too cheap for what you're getting, then buy it. Because I'd look at kind of what else was going on. I look at things on a pound per square foot basis. So that you're comparing kind of apples and apples,
right.
Apples and oranges. How do you know if that's a good deal or not? How do you know if it's priced rightly? You can work it out. There are ways to do that. So everything I bought at a very low pound per square foot. And I always sold it at a significantly increased pound per square foot. And as I say, some of that was because I added value. Some of that was because of market timing. But ultimately, it gets you to the same point. I locked in that capital appreciation and it's tax-free.
So as you continue to develop, grow your portfolio, is what's in the mix for you? What's in the sites? Are you getting into hotels? What are you looking into?
I'm having lots of interesting conversations at the moment. The deals are getting kind of bigger and more interesting. That means they're kind of slightly scarier for me, but I'm really trying to kind of step outside that comfort zone. And as I said, when you do your homework and you do enough due diligence and you ask the right questions, then you can get comfortable or more comfortable with those kind of that type of risk. It's, as John says, earn your right to risk. And I'm very, very much believe in that philosophy. I don't invest in anything that I don't understand, and I'll take a long time to kind of research and to understand kind of as much as I can about something before I get into it. I think it's really the deals are getting bigger and juicier. When you start to be able to access deals of a certain size, not everybody can do those, so the margins on those are kind of nicer, are more appealing. So it's not that they're necessarily kind of different projects, they're just bigger in scale, which is, yeah. And there's some really interesting talks about doing more of that stuff going forward. So it's very exciting. And it's a really interesting time for the market in the UK at the moment. It's, you know, house prices have come off. We've got all the uncertainty because of the B word, Brexit, and, you know, still don't know what's going to happen there. But actually, it feels like there's real opportunities at the moment. There's going to be more this year. So it's really exciting.
What kind of unique places do you have properties around the world?
To be honest, my investment stuff is all in the UK at the moment. That's okay. Not kind of sexy at all. But where I spend my time is Malta and Bermuda and London, obviously. And I'm trying to spend more time in Malta, particularly because I've just got a place over there. The climate and everything is certainly more favourable. But things have been really busy. So I'm in London right now, and it's raining, and I really wish I was in Malta right now. Sun. I'm a sun kind of person. So
I love both of those. Out there in the sunshine.
Yes, yeah. I've got good friends in Bermuda, so I spend a lot of time over there. Although I've not been yet this year because things have been so busy, and I'm really missing that, and I'm really missing them. But yeah, I spent a lot of time in Malta, so I've got friends who've come out and seen me there, so that's really nice. I've got more people coming out in July as well, so yeah, that's fun. I love that. I love having somewhere that people can come and see me, and I can show them that island as well, because I've been going there for probably 10 years, and that, I have to say, feels more like home than London does now. So yeah, it's a really interesting shift for me.
How did you end up there?
My parents have been going to Malta since, oh gosh, probably even before I was born. Yeah, we'd take my brother there, and we'd go on holidays there as well when I was little. And then they ended up buying a timeshare, much against my advice, about 15 years ago. Anyway, yeah, not everybody listens to me. It's worked fine for them, and they love it, and they still have that. So they started going about 15 years ago. And then actually when I got ill and I left JP Morgan, so after kind of 2008, I started going out there a lot with them, and would just spend more and more time out there, particularly in the winter. As I say, you know, UK is not my favourite place to be in the winter. And especially over the last few years, it got an economic kind of decision. Like, I'm spending so much on being out there on hotels and things, I'm like, actually it just makes sense to get some of myself now, so that's what I've done, and I love it. I love having a base there. I can go backwards and forwards from it. Yeah, it's
great. The tropics are great.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, when I lived in Miami Beach, it was lovely.
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah. I've got a good friend. I've not been to Miami, actually. I really must go. I've got a friend there that keeps inviting me. And yeah, I just need to find...
Plenty of ocean views everywhere you go.
Exactly. And that's what I love about exactly Malta and Bermuda as well. Where I am in Malta, I'm just overlooking this beautiful bay. And there's just something really very grounding and calming about being near the sea for me. It's beautiful energy. And I just... Look, I'm just going all like dreamy eyed thinking about it already. I'm gonna be there on Monday.
Yeah. So soon.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, how much has your studying in psychology and philosophy played a role with you as an investor and being in a world of probably more dominated by men?
Oh, massively. Massively. It's I just find it, and I guess I always have found human behavior really fascinating. I'm just looking around at my books now. I can't see my bookshelf behind me, but everything I'm reading about is all, you know, human behavior and psychology. And it really, really is fundamental. Not only actually from a human behavior perspective, but also looking at your, and actually I was listening to Lewis Mocker, the interview that you did with him. I found that really fascinating. And he was talking about, kind of the psychology of stuff as well. It was really, really good interview. I really enjoyed that. Forgot where I was going with that. But it's really kind of the mindset. That's where I was going. The mindset, and he talks about it. I think like looking at your own, like yourself, understanding yourself, why do you do what you do? What are your limiting beliefs? Where have they come from? And that's not in a judgmental way. It's just do you want to transcend those? Do you want to go beyond those? And actually that all then filters into kind of the purpose and the finance and the, you know, just even the kind of the making money side. For me, the investment side of it, you know, I kind of reach certain plateaus and I realize there's a resistance to going beyond that. And I'm like, right, let's go and dig around in there, find out what am I telling myself? What do I believe? What am I trying to avoid? Or what am I, you know, afraid of? What's happening in there? And when I do go in there and look at that stuff and, you know, really kind of break it down and let go of that, surrender to that stuff, then I'm ready to take that next leap. And it's liberating. I feel like I'm growing as a person. And my, you know, my soul's growing, if that doesn't sound kind of too esoteric. But but literally it translates into money as well for me. It really does. It works on kind of every different level when you start looking at this stuff, the mindset. It's so I find it very fascinating, but also very empowering as well.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your story and your insights on property investment and, you know, what it's like to be a, you know, a female in that male dominated world.
Yes. Yeah. My absolute pleasure. I've been kind of doing more speaking and kind of more interviews and things this year because, you know, I think there's a lot of women that look at this stuff and can feel a little intimidated. And honestly, if I can do it, then so can they. And that's what I want to, you know, I just want to kind of inspire other people to kind of take that step and do it sensibly. I'm all about do it sensibly. Don't jump in. Don't get emotional about it. Do it sensibly, but it can be done sensibly. And yeah. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. Enjoy your stay in Malta next week.
Oh, I shall. Sunshine. Yeah.